Hi, you're listening to Magnifico Radio. I'm your host, Kate Black, and each week I sit down with leaders, makers, and designers at the forefront of sustainability to discuss their journeys and motivation. Whether it's ethical fashion, clean beauty, or sustainable products, they're all doing something Magnifico. Today's show is supported by Bank & Vogue, creators of innovative and relevant solutions to the crisis of stuff. A 20-year history of clothing collection, a highly successful vintage retail chain, and a global manufacturer of innovative products made out of post-consumer goods. Visit bankvogue.com to find out more. A new report released in November of 2017 estimates that there are over 1,900 chemicals used in textile and garment production, and 165 are known to be harmful to personal or environmental health. Today's guest found himself accidentally thrust into exposing the truth about hidden harmful chemicals when his young daughters received a brand new pair of kids' pajamas that didn't smell right. John Whalen is the director of Stink, an offbeat documentary about his tenacious quest to uncover the source of the chemical scent on those pajamas. And like most Americans, Whalen believed that if a product was on the store shelf, it was safe. Through his investigation, Whalen discovered a culture of secrecy surrounding carcinogens in everyday consumer products and has joined the leagues of consumers who want transparency in product labeling. Welcome, John.
Thanks.
So for those who haven't seen the film, can you talk about the path that the pajamas started you on?
Sure. The pajamas came before the film. And basically what happened, I bought my daughter a pair of pajamas she asked for as a Christmas present. They came in the mail. I opened the package. It had a horrible smell. So I said, why did these things stink? And I called the company and they gave me the runaround, which I thought was kind of odd. You know, you think if you call for a kid's product, they want you to feel warm and cuddly about their response. But it was more, you know, after I kept asking them, it's like, well, it's proprietary. I'm like, proprietary? I just want to know if the pajamas are safe. And because they didn't give me a good answer, I decided, what would happen if I take these pajamas, go down the rabbit hole, don't take no for an answer, and go back and see why they stink.
And what kind of time frame did that happen over?
I mean, it was months going back and forth, but I called everyone because, like I said, once I decided I wasn't taking no for an answer, I was just on it.
And you actually sent the pajamas away for testing, which is amazing. And so many consumers and so many people that I come across in my work always ask, like, how come we don't know more? How did you know how to do that and how much did it cost?
So let me just say this first. So the first thing I did, you know, after calling the company, I said, all right, who'd be the next logical people to call? And that's the Consumer Product Safety Commission, because they're the federal regulator of types of products like that. And I asked them and I said, is there a list of chemicals you can't use in children's sleepwear? And they said, no. And so I said, okay, well, what if I want to find out what's in these pajamas? And they said, you'd have to ask the manufacturer. I said, well, I've been down that road. So the lady said, so I guess the only thing left for you to do is send them to a lab. So, you know, I went, as many do, to google.com, and I found a lab in California, vetted them and just make sure that they were reputable. And, you know, I think that test was somewhere in the ballpark of $1,200. But the thing, it's hard, like one thing, it's a little misleading because, you know, if you went to a doctor for a physical and said, I want to get a physical, the doctor would understand that you're kind of looking to find out that everything is working. But when you want to test a product, you have to be very specific. So you have to test it. There's certain types of tests for certain type of chemicals, so you're not getting this sort of comprehensive analysis. So I was most concerned with why it smells. And without giving too much away and having them identify what makes these pajamas stink, they found something else.
And I think that that's a really good point, because $1,200 is cost prohibitive for most people who are really interested in what's the makeup of their favorite product. Had you made films before?
No. I mean, I was involved in producing a film unrelated to this. It was a comedy, which was like a bit of a red herring, but this was the first documentary. And, you know, I feel like being a little bit naive, having not done it, can be a good thing. And I think it was a good thing because you don't have any preconceived notions. This is exactly how you have to do it, you know, and especially this journey was somewhat bizarre. It's probably good that I didn't have the set parameters in my head. This is the way you have to do it.
And did it start like as soon as you got on the phone with a company and started to get the runaround, were you like, somebody should make a movie about this? Or was it, I'm just going to record this and see what happens and then kind of find yourself making a documentary?
Prior to that, I had an idea for a documentary, which had to do with scented products. And I was actually pursuing it with a couple of friends who were in production. And this kind of just fell on my lap. So it sort of changed the course of the documentary. It made us do it 2 months, started 2 minutes earlier than we anticipated. But the pajamas were kind of this thing that just kind of happened. And it turned out to be good because I think that, you know, people, I think there's some documentaries that are very, there's just a lot of information. And the fact that I was able to use the pajamas as kind of a symbol or a metaphor to traverse the system, I think made it less complicated for people to kind of wrap their heads around.
Okay. And consumers are confused about the distinction between FDA approved and FDA regulated. And so what's the difference and why does that matter?
Well, I think that, you know, for drugs where people are making health claims, prescription drugs, they have to be approved. And I think that people think that all products under the FDA's purview have the same thing. But they don't. And so, you know, if you look at food or, you know, cosmetics, personal care products, they're really, companies are more or less on the honor system. You know, and again, it's a little different in food than for cosmetics. Let's say with cosmetics and fragrance, the FDA doesn't approve those products. The company, it's their job to make sure they're safe. And there's very few chemicals that the FDA actually prohibits from these products. I think there's 12. And as you probably know, in Europe, it's 1,396. So there's something different with our science or our lobbying, or it's just when you see that vast difference, it really makes you wonder. And what I would say is that, you know, the big difference, and here's what it comes down to, in Europe, they adhere to something called the precautionary principle, which is very controversial in the United States. And it's a fancy way of saying common sense. It says, if we suspect something is dangerous, well, let's not use it. Whereas in America, chemicals are innocent until proven guilty. And proving guilt is virtually impossible. Just to give you an example with a different agency, you know, we all know asbestos is bad. It comes with a signature disease. The only way you can get mesothelioma is from asbestos exposure. Yet they couldn't even ban that. It was initially banned and it got overturned. So if you can't ban a chemical or an ingredient that has a signature cancer, then you pretty much can't ban anything.
And it's interesting because I think that because we have so many environmental inputs now, like the chemical that you uncover in the film is kind of proliferates everything and almost every product. So because we now can't have a smoking gun to say that product gave me this cancer, how do you think we're going to fare as we move forward and as companies continue to kind of go at will to make these ingredients or these concoctions without any oversight?
So one of my biggest takeaways, and I'll answer your question, the problem isn't that these companies are breaking the law. The problem is that the law is broken. But most people don't realize that. And as we move to more sophisticated and novel ingredients and nanotechnologies and nanoparticles, ingredients so small they can actually drift into internal organs, okay? So try figuring out what that's doing in your body. But I think the problem is that, you know, when people walk into a store, they assume if it's on the shelf, it's safe. They see these beautiful packages with slick marketing that are endorsed by celebrities, and they really don't give it a second thought. But in my experience, every single product, I think every single product that I sent to a lab, the results showed the presence of chemicals that if it was on the label, I wouldn't have bought the product. And so to answer your question, I think the key, and this isn't the silver bullet to solve all of our woes, but the key is transparency. Because if people know what's in all the products they buy, then a lot of people will start asking why they're there. Retailers are able to do a better job curating, and people in the health community will be able to associate these chemicals with different health issues. And I think because we don't have a system that is fully transparent. I think it's really a moral hazard issue on the supply side, meaning that companies really don't have an incentive to create better products if there's really no downside. There's really not strict penalties. And at the same time, you know, I mean, I look at this through an economic lens. I went to business school. I understand it. I'm not like a tree hugger saying this is how we have to do it. I think that on the supply side, if you're a company and you preempt your competitors and do the right thing, like honestly, you're probably not going to get much credit in the marketplace and it could crush you. So it's scary for a brand to take that bold step to do the right thing when you're not going to get credit for it in the marketplace. And so the question is, how do we create incentivize these companies? And I think that, you know, by forcing them all at the same time through transparency, because, you know, otherwise they're not going to say, you know, I'm going to admit that I'm selling a baby product with the carcinogens if someone isn't saying you have to disclose that. And the minute they have to disclose that, they're going to take it out.
And so do you think, back to this, chemicals are innocent until proven guilty. Right now in this North American system, we're depending on NGOs to kind of make that revelation or kind of do that research. Do you think that that's an equitable system where companies can put it out, the chemicals are innocent, and then an NGO or some sort of environmental group has to come back and do all of the research? Like, is that kind of an economic model that's going to be sustainable?
Absolutely not. You know, just to give you an idea of and it comes down to money. You know, we could talk about any problem in America and it's going to come down to money in politics. So I'll shelf that for now. But just to give you an idea, every industry has a trade association. And then there's sort of this umbrella trade association, the American Chemistry Council, that represents chemical companies. And every product has chemicals. And I'm of the opinion that most chemicals are safe. The problem is that a lot of the cheapest chemistry is the most used and the most harmful. And, you know, the American Chemistry Council's, their membership, their dues is in excess of $100 million a year. So that's what they have to lobby against regulation, to lobby against transparency. And so then you have NGOs that are sending products to laboratories, which represents a minuscule amount of the products on the market. And I think that, you know, even when they find the presence of these chemicals, the trade associations are quick to fire back. Well, you know, the fact that it's present doesn't mean anything. Well, that's been used safely for 40 years. Oh, that chemical is also found in apples. Oh, a study done in Bulgaria by a plumber found that that's safe. You know, it's just endless. And it's the tobacco playbook. And it's just we keep allowing them to sort of recycle these sort of silly platitudes that give politicians cover so they can say, oh, well, we're not 100% sure, so let's not do anything. And most of these guys, I mean, look at the demographics of Congress. You know, the old white guys, like, they probably haven't even walked into a store. You know what I mean? And so when someone say they want to regulate what's in cosmetics or clothes, they're like, what are you talking about? You know, they're just, and again, in their defense, there's so many different issues, so this may not seem like the biggest things. And people really can't connect the dots between all of the chemicals we're all inundated with and the rise of disease, let's say, just in the last 40 years.
I think that's true. And if we're going to go with all the stereotypes, like, I think let's use Old Spice as an example of something that maybe an old white guy might have in his shelf. I don't think they also realize how much the industry has changed in an economy of efficiency and price reduction to swap out what might have been a safe ingredient for a synthetic or something that is deemed questionable or suspect. So will you be happy if we get transparency? Like, is that all that needs to happen in this industry? Or is that just the beginning of the snowball for you?
I think transparency is a prerequisite to change. Once they have to disclose all of those chemicals, then it's going to change the way they compete. Because, you know, in the past, let's say 60 years, the emphasis was on creating a brand. Because, you know, after World War II, you wanted to be able to differentiate yourselves from the local brands. And if you have a national brand, kind of like, you know, people, they associate recognition from trust. So I trust it because I've seen it. And that's not the way you should look at it. And so we need transparency. I'll give you an example. if I'm selling a product that has a bunch of crappy ingredients in it, and I'm on social media, millennials love it, and it's sort of this hot product, and you have a competitor which has the more healthful version of that. Let's say you have all fake stuff, they have all real stuff, and your product is twice as much money. So in the eye of the consumer, doesn't know anything about these issues we're talking about, it looks like this product just costs twice as much. But if they had to disclose the ingredients, and the crappy product you saw had 150 ingredients, and a lot of them were just complete crap, and then the other one had a few ingredients, and they looked pretty wholesome, then people would view it in a different way. It's just that because of the lack of transparency, it's really hard to know the difference between the perception of a product and the reality of the product. And the reality of the product doesn't really come into place until you disclose all the ingredients.
Okay, we need to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and I'm going to talk to you about one ingredient in particular.
Are you looking for natural and organic beauty products to detoxify your life? Then you need the Detox Market. What started as a pop-up shop on Abbot Kinney in Venice Beach back in 2010 has turned into the most trusted source of clean beauty, with shops in both LA and Toronto, where shoppers can smell, try, and learn about the latest in organic skincare, natural makeup, and more. The Detox Market is the go-to resource for those who believe in the power of pure products. Check them out online at thedetoxmarket.com and visit their YouTube channel for tips and product reviews.
We're back, and you're listening to Kate Black. This is Magnifico Radio, and I'm sitting with John Whalen, the director of Stink, a new movie about transparency and the chemicals that we have in everything. So in the film starts with phthalates. So why are those a chemical of concern, especially for young girls?
So phthalates are part of a larger class of chemicals called, you know, hormone disruptors or endocrine disrupting chemicals. And, you know, especially for a developing body, you know, you don't want to be exposed to chemicals which have a profound change in your development. Things that can happen, exposures when you're young, that can lead to health outcomes that would happen prematurely or come into play 20 years from now. And there's a lot of hormone disrupting chemicals. I think awareness in Europe is much greater. And, you know, they're not even, all of them are disclosed on product labels. And so I think from a parent's perspective, if there was complete transparency, you go to a store and you're buying your 10-year-old shampoo, one says contains hormone-disrupting chemicals, and the other one says does not contain hormone-disrupting chemicals. Well, which would you buy? It's pretty simple. And that's why so much effort is spent so they don't have to disclose. But it's scary. And the thing with a lot of these endocrine-disrupting chemicals, this sort of classic notion of, like, the industry likes to say with carcinogens, the dose makes the poison. It's okay to be exposed to a little bit of carcinogens. And I always say, well, how about no carcinogens? But with hormone disruptors, what's called the dose response curve, sounds so geeky, is inverse, meaning that a little exposure over time may be worse than one big exposure. And so that's counterintuitive. And that's why, you know, it's particularly scary with these companies, because there are a little bit of these chemicals, but the average person using 12 products a day, it's also in your food, it adds up. And by the time the damage is done, you don't know. And so I think that that's one of the big shifts. If you were selling a product and you were using a shampoo and it made you keel over in the shower and die, well, they get it off the market pretty fast. But, you know, look at cigarettes. If I smoke a cigarette today, I'm not going to die tomorrow. If I'm exposed to asbestos today, I won't get mesothelioma tomorrow. It's about exposures today that lead to health outcomes in the future. And I'm not saying that the phthalates or anything like a cigarette or asbestos. I'm just saying that, you know, if people had more information, they would make different choices.
And what do you think that delay is? Because I think consumers get what they put in their body affects their health. I think we actually have a movement around that, and organic food sales show that we have a movement around that. But why don't they feel the same way about personal care products and the things that they put on their skin?
I think awareness for what you put in your body is pretty good nowadays. I think the next level is like what you're putting on your body and what's around your body. And I don't think people connect the dots and realize that if you put a body lotion, if you rub something in your skin, it gets in your bloodstream the same way. And so I just don't think people make that connection. You know, if you're smelling something, that it's getting to your bloodstream the same way. It's all the same. It's just a different route of getting into your blood. And it has the same impact. And, you know, whether it's, you know, people You know, like vaping is like a big thing with kids now. And some of the chemicals used in vaping are horrible. Most of them are just horrible. But, you know, the industry markets these devices as a, you know, a smoking cessation device. And but then if you look at the stores, it's all kids who are buying it. You know, so they're it's completely disingenuous. And I think that that's true for a lot of products where they know that people are going to look at the feature or the perceived value of the product and turn a blind eye to what's inside the bottle.
Well, and that brings me back to why I asked the question about transparency and if that's going to do it, because companies are very adept at switching out chemicals once consumer awareness or NGO attention falls on it. And we know that that one's bad, then there's a replacement and the chemistry just can't keep up with the innovation of replacement. So how is transparency really going to keep us safe in the end if we don't have legislation or some sort of top-down directive to really fix this problem?
So I'll put on my entrepreneurial hat. I think there's an amazing opportunity right now for entrepreneurs to create the better version of every conventional product on the market. So that will happen. It'll either happen because someone within the company says, we need to sort of green up our chemistry and create a better product, or someone on the outside is going to say, let's knock this product off, but with modern chemistry. And I think a lot of people will be very successful. But the thing, I have more faith in the fact if everyone had to disclose all of the ingredients, then the retailers wouldn't be able to play this game where it's like, oh, we're just common carriers. We're just pushing boxes. We have no idea what's in it. You know, let the buyer beware. They would have to really be more responsible. And, you know, you'd be shocked at all these products. But one thing I just want to go back to saying, you know, the fact that an NGO says there's all of these bad chemicals, I mean, in my experience, that doesn't in itself warrant change, because what typically happens is a trade association puts out a press release and tries to debunk or just trivialize what they found. It's only when there's something like the example that comes to mind is with the Johnson & Johnson baby shampoo having, you know, formaldehyde in the product that, and I still don't know. Companies usually say, well, we're going to phase that out, but then, you know, because they wouldn't have to disclose on the label, you don't know if it's still there anyway.
Or the talc.
You're right.
Lawsuit. Okay, so let's talk about kids. So how old are your daughters now?
They're 14 and 11.
Okay, so you are in the crux that a lot of parents are, which is that your daughters are being bombarded by marketing messages all the time, and it's regardless of what is in the product. So how are you combating this pressure of consumption that gets played out on your daughters? What can they buy? What can't they buy? And how does that conversation go?
It's a tough issue, I'll say that. But I think that, you know, what I've always tried to do with my kids is make them healthy skeptics. But my approach is a little different. And, you know, we'll take food. I think especially, you know, you live here in New York, we're so disconnected from the sort of our food system. I'm stating the obvious. But, you know, since they're really young, I've always had them very involved in actually the preparation of food. And because of that, they have these, you know, pretty fine-tuned palates for real food. You know, sautéed broccoli, if you give them something, they can know very quickly if it's not good. And so I think that's helped a lot on the food front. I'm not going to say that if they're at their friend's house and they're offering them something else, they're not going to take it. But I think the key takeaway, one thing that I've tried to instill is that there can be the better version of something you love that's like complete junk. And I think we're getting back to that a lot with food. It's like there's a company, not to go off the rails here, in Brooklyn that makes like the organic version of the Hostess products we grew up on, which I think is like really funny. And they'll say like, here's the six ingredients in your ring ding, you know, where you look in the one in the grocery store, it has like 180 ingredients. So I think I try to be pretty good instead of trying to be 100%. And I think that's what works for me. Cause I think if you try to like clamp down and be that person that it's like, it's, this is the only way, I think that's when the kid, you know, is really going to rebel. And so I'd say I'd give us a a B plus and A minus. And I think that's really worked. And, you know, in terms of the cosmetics and the fragrance, they're not really in the younger one. She's like a little young, and the older one sort of maybe went through that phase briefly, but she was also savvy enough to know if I'm going to buy this product, I'm going to first go to the EWG website and look in skin deep. And she'd say to me, you know, I want this. It's a one on EWG. And she still does that. Like if she wants something, you know, where if she brings in a crap product into the house, we have this thing, it somehow it disappears. It goes into my closet. And so we you know, I kind of joke about it and I'll say, you know this about this product, and they kind of get it. You know, it's hard too. Like, as you know, like things will like clothes, like that's a whole different conversation with clothes because it's a complicated industry. And, you know, what we get, what winds up in our closet and understanding the supply chain is complicated. But I think I give my kids a lot of information, trying to like make it kind of funny or just, you know, interesting so that they get the information and it's not like just trying to ram it down their throat. Like, don't do this, don't wear that. And I'll turn a blind eye to certain things for the greater good and maintain domestic tranquility.
Nice. And this will be an awkward question, but do they have friends? Because sometimes when the kids know all of that stuff, they want to impart the knowledge on their cohorts and classmates. And maybe your daughters probably know more than their classmates. So does it make some friction for them when they're out in public or when they're at school and they know the difference between a good product and a bad product?
So I would say, like, I'm not that person. Like if I went to a friend's house and they had like products that I knew were complete crap, I probably wouldn't point it out. And, you know, so I'm not really preachy that way. And I don't think they are either. Like if someone asked them, they'll answer and they probably know enough to be dangerous. But one funny thing that I will say, some of my younger daughter's friends will not, like if there's a sleepover, they don't want to sleep over at my house because they like me, but they know that there's not going to be the junk food that they have at their house. And so, but then like my older daughter, some of her friends are like, oh my God, that whatever you make is amazing. I want to come over for that. Now they maybe appreciate it a little more. So I would say it works both ways, but, I don't know. I think it's like an age too for a kid. Like you don't want to be, preachy with your friends about things because the reality is, and one of the challenges is that like, I'm not going to critique what another family does. Like that's their decision. If they have all of these products, you know, If they don't know, they don't know. I think that people kind of don't want to know some information. And especially because I'm not a woman, like when one of their friend's mother says something, like she has more credibility in that department, but I might actually have more information. So it gets a little awkward.
Yes. And so overall, when you look back, how has the movie and how has this journey changed your life?
I would say that my biggest takeaway from the movie, because I was like kind of aware of some of these issues, but I think the biggest shocker for me was the systemic issue. You know, again, just how with the right amount of money, you can keep the wrong system in place. And that kind of opened my eyes to a lot of different things. And so, you know, I just feel like I'm more aware and sort of I kind of look at everything through a different lens, and that's good. But also it's bad because like in a previous life I was, you know, been involved in like, starting business and things. And now I'm more like, ooh, I kind of feel like in some things I know too much. I don't want to start the type of business that I'd be a hypocrite if it was, you know, contributing the things that I see as a problem. So it's kind of restricted what I can do and still, you know, look my kids in the eye. So I don't know. I feel like I'm optimistic. There's a lot of things going on in the world now that can make you really down and, you know, bad things happening in different agencies and the regulations that most people don't know about are getting worse. But I think that I'm confident that entrepreneurs will create the better version of things and people will respond to it and appreciate the fact that they're trying to sort of get back to the basics and just do the right thing.
I like that. And I liked how you said earlier that there's a better product for everything that you love or everything you want. You know, with a smartphone or a connection to the internet, you can probably find a better product. We're getting to that stage. How do you feel about the campaigns? Like, how do you feel about the campaign for Safe Cosmetics or the campaigns that are really trying to activate some awareness in consumers? And then I saw you write an op-ed in Huffington Post about Pink Ribbon. So how do you feel about the way that the campaigns are kind of sitting in the marketplace?
So I think the campaigns are great. I think one of the challenges, if you look at the sort of the concentric circle that these campaigns reach, if we have three rings and the inner band is the sweet spot, it's people who are kind of aware of these issues already, and it's the media. You know, getting to a more mainstream audience is really hard, whether it's through documentary or just through the information, because we're competing with so many different other things. And I think, you know, part of it too is people don't want to hear it. You know, there's cognitive dissonance. Oh, geez, another thing is bad for me. And also, you know, and I get it. Like, things are price sensitive. It's, you know, people know that, you know, I'm buying this for my family. I wish I could afford that, but it's more money. And that's what really gets me, that like, you can't, you have to make decisions that you know aren't the greatest for your family just because these companies are being sneaky, and, you know, some things just cost more money. But to get back to what you said, that, yeah, the campaigns are great for raising awareness, and I think it is bringing change. I think some of the legislation now, the devil is always in the details. And if you look back over time, the industry seems to always get something in there that 2 years later, people are scratching their heads. They're like, they did it again. You know, it just happened with Tosca. And, you know, that when the trade associations say, we're fine with this legislation, I'm like, oh, we better really read this, because if they're fine with it, because the last thing they want to do is reformulate their products. And so if they're agreeing to it, it must mean there's some way that they don't have to reformulate.
But they don't necessarily always have to reformulate, because they have, under the EU restrictions, they have the formulations. Like, the Pantene that they make there is not the Pantene they're making here. And so that's, in a lot of cases, in a lot of products, that's not the issue.
Yeah, I think the other thing is that, you know, these companies, because they don't have to disclose the ingredients, then there's a bunch of loopholes, as you probably know. So there's this, may I tell a loophole story?
Yes.
So aside from the fact that there's this fragrance loophole, okay, and what that means is that if you look at a product ingredient, you see the word fragrance, and that appears to be a singular ingredient, but it's actually used in lieu of disclosing the actual ingredients, which could be 100. And of those 100 ingredients, it could include chemicals that are associated with cancer or birth defects or allergens or hormone disruptors. I'm not saying all of them, but it could be. And so if they had to disclose some of those ingredients on the bottle, people wouldn't buy it. But they see fragrance, and it's positive camouflage, because who doesn't like a pleasant scent? And so people buy it. Now, the other thing, and this is my favorite loophole. I hate to play favorites, but you could find a chemical in a product, okay, and the company would say, and they'd legally have the basis to say this, it wasn't intentionally added. What does that mean? So if you had an ingredient, a raw material, and it was contaminated with something really bad, okay, and it went into the product, you would say, well, it wasn't intentionally added. Yes, there's asbestos, it wasn't intentionally added. And that would be fine. The other thing, that this is even better, if you know it, like basic chemistry, if you add chemical A with chemical B, well, it creates chemical C. Now, let's say chemical A and B are fine, but chemical C is carcinogenic. Well, you stick it in the bottle, it creates this carcinogen, you screw the cap on, and, you know, someone says, we have benzene in your product. Says, well, it wasn't intentionally added, it was a chemical reaction. It's just like, at some point, it's just like, we have to call BS on all of this and get us all in the room and say, guys, come on. You know, it's just like everything is so deceptive. You know, even like Tropicana orange juice or something like that. You know, it's the same thing with food. If you look, it says 100% Florida orange juice. Well, a reasonable person would take it at its face value. The totality of this product is 100% pure orange juice. But if you ask a lawyer for the industry, they say, no, that's not what it's saying. It's saying that the orange juice in that product is 100% pure orange juice. So there could be other things in there. It's just that every product, there's kind of a backstory and there's a trick and there's a loophole. And that's why I'm like interested in sort of the anthropological aspects of this, aside from sort of the advocacy, because it's just, how are they getting away with this? And that's kind of the angle that I like to look at it. And aside from the economic angle, because I think that's what's kind of needed, because, it's in addition to what these campaigns about what chemicals are in there, it's also changing the perception of products just by knowing more about them.
It's true. Back in my previous life, I worked in advertising, and I worked for an agency that had a fast food client who had trademarked their meat process as 100% pure beef. The process was trademarked, not the contents of the beef. So it was easy to use this trademark label and have the consumer assume that that meant content as opposed to process, which is, I think, really nefarious. Like, it's not what consumers expect. Back to our original comment, when they see something on a shelf, they expect that it's going to be healthy or not necessarily harm us, and that it's going to be what it says it is.
Right.
So did you want to make a comment on pink ribbons?
Yeah. So I wrote this op-ed for the Huffington Post, and I mean, a bit of a provocative title was, "Do Pink Ribbons Cause Cancer?" And if you read the op-ed, what I was saying is that, you know, a lot of companies during October, Breast Cancer Awareness Month, put these pink ribbons on their products. And so I think from the consumer standpoint, oh, that's great. I'm buying this product. A portion of those funds are going to breast cancer research. But, you know, of course, the pink ribbon isn't regulated, so it doesn't actually mean that. And some of the products that sell these pink ribbon products actually have chemicals that can cause cancer. So the perverse irony of someone trying to raise money to cure cancer by selling chemicals that can cause cancer is just, you know, if that doesn't say it all, I don't know what does. But just, there's so much, like, going back what you said, in advertising and deception, and there's a fine line between deception and clever marketing. It's like everything. Like, if you see a vanilla toothpaste, well, you know, people loved vanilla. And it's popular. It's like, wow, this looks great. But if you call the company and you said, does this have actual vanilla in it? Well, they won't answer that question. But so I'll give you like the inside baseball on this. So real vanilla is very expensive. So the likelihood of there being real vanilla in your toothpaste is pretty slim. But because it's legal to use virtually any chemical to create a flavor or a fragrance, there could be some axle grease smells like vanilla that could be in there and it would be perfectly legal. But one thing that's kind of funny is there's a chemical that comes from the sack of a Canadian beaver's anus. I can't believe the name is escaping me. This should roll right off the tongue. And it just happens to smell like vanilla. I don't ask me how they found that out, but it does. And so, like, if you're calling, you're putting this thing in your mouth, I think you have a right to know if it's actually vanilla. But it's just like everything. Like, you see scented this or flavored that, you know, it's like the duck test. If it swims like a duck, it looks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. But the duck test doesn't work in America when you walk into a store, because it's all about selling the sizzle. And when you start asking questions about the steak, you get stiff-armed.
And so then what's your mode of advice? So if I was a neighbor and I was open to some feedback about you sharing your knowledge, what would you tell me, or what would you tell people who kind of start to understand this problem and want to make change for themselves or their families?
I mean, I guess it's twofold. One, there are a lot of good companies out there. And honestly, a lot of, like, the bigger companies, there's good people working there. It's not like they're like sitting around, how can we poison kids? It's just that it's complicated, especially when you're a public company. There's so much pressure to make more money every quarter. You know, you either sell more stuff or you cut the price of what you're selling by cutting corners. And so I get it. And so, unfortunately, you know, a lot of the companies are doing the right thing. You have to charge a premium because their input, it's just more. And so I think that, you know, my advice is, I just look for products that are simple. You know, you look on the label, there's just the fewer ingredients, better. And also, like, I kind of question, is this product, like, legit? Is this a solution to a problem that's legitimate, or did they create it on Madison Avenue? you know, and there's so many instances of that. And, you know, I think that, you know, whether it's, you know, just like basic stuff, you know, it gets more complicated with clothes. But there's tons of, you know, if you want a pair of jeans, like I don't want to like drop names, but there's like nudie jeans. They're down on the Lower East Side. It's like they have this whole thing about like sustainability, and they'll tell you everything about the product, and if they ever get ripped, they'll fix them there for free. And so, you know, Patagonia with clothes, they'll take stuff back, and they're trying to like emphasize using stuff in just in a different way. So I think there is this movement, and I think, you know, it's sort of a luxury item to be able to buy some of these things. And so I'm not trying to, it doesn't solve the problem for everyone, you know, and having awareness and being able to shop your way around these problems we're talking about, it doesn't fix the problem. And most people are never going to know about this problem. And that's why I just think that, you know, companies and retailers have to be more responsible as the NGOs are doing their work and trying to create more awareness, but it's hard. But you know, what we do know, once people start demanding safer products, companies will start delivering us safer products.
Especially by a written letter. There's nothing like a letter to kind of activate change. So now that we've piqued everybody's curiosity, those who haven't seen the movie, where can they go to see Stink, the movie?
So if you go to stinkmovie.com, you can, you know, it links to where it's available on iTunes and Amazon and Vimeo, and you can actually watch it for free now. At stinkmovie.com. It's in addition to English, it's available in Spanish, Portuguese, Chinese, and as of next week, it'll also be available in French, German, and Arabic.
Amazing. So you can watch it and then send the link to everybody else that you know. So I have some standard questions that I ask every guest. Who or what inspires you?
I think my kids inspire me the most now because I feel like I know I have this esoteric information in my head, and I'm trying to like think about like their futures and trying to make like changes that can make the world a better place. And so when I hear what they say, you know, just that's kind of inspiring to know what they're thinking and to see what they're into and trying to figure out things in that way.
And what's next on your bucket list? What are you working towards?
So I'm actually working on a podcast that's sort of morphed into something bigger than a podcast that I'm trying to put to the pieces together now. I don't know what it's going to be, what the format will be, because it's just exploded, but like in a good way, because kind of like in Stink, where I was looking for something, I found something else. And, you know, I went down and found out a bunch of interesting things, but, it's interesting, and I'm like literally like I getting information from 100 years ago and trying to put the pieces together. So maybe it's a documentary or it's like a serial podcast or something. But I think it's kind of interesting.
Okay, stay tuned. And if people wanted to book a screening or get in touch with you, how can they do that?
All through the website, stinkmovie.com.
Okay. If your life had a motto, what would it be?
You mean the one I'll say now, and then I'm on that elevator, I'm like, why did I say that? I'm going to say something like, I'm going to quote Richard Nixon's lawyer. When people keep secrets, it's for a reason.
Amazing. Okay, great. So thank you, John. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
If you want to watch Stink, again, go to stinkmovie.com. And that's been another episode of Magnifico Radio. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to great podcasts. And if you like what you hear, give us a review or a rating. It'll help Magnifico Radio rank higher amongst conventional fashion and beauty podcasts. And want to learn more about clean and non-toxic beauty? Sign up for our newsletter at magnifico.com. I'm Kate Black. Thanks for listening.